Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Join us on Thursday as we explore Pet Health and Homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath Debbie Bruck, and Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, author and homeopath Christina Chambreau. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go!
Okay, we're going live. And we are on the line with Dr. Christina Chambreau this morning. We're going to be talking about pet health and blocks to cure, things that are obstacles in the case. I'd also like to welcome her today because this is a once-a-month show now. And visit her website, myhealthyanimals.com. She has a special upcoming announcement that there will be homeopathy classes for those who are interested May 11th through May 25th in Vancouver, British Columbia. This is for beginning to advanced practitioners. And she is empowering you to heal yourself and your animal companions in ways that also heal the planet. You're going to learn how to check the early warning signs of illness and start evaluating your animal's health. We're also going to be talking about that today. And you're going to learn a lot more to better understand your animal's health issues and discover a wide spectrum of affordable and effective healing options. A great place to start is the 7 Keys to Health, and we had many, many series about that on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio. You can get a head start by looking at the archives that we have here. Discover the health products, and she has a lot over... How many years have you been practicing, Christina?
Well, I graduated from vet school in 1980, and I started homeopathy in 1982.
So that's been a number of years there.
And I started working at a veterinary clinic when I was 11 years old in 1961.
Yeah, we're really we're telling our age today.
I love it. I'm 60. What am I? 62. So I love it. I love getting older.
You love getting older.
Yeah.
You're going to tell me why?
Absolutely. I get wiser and wiser as I get older.
And you keep your memory?
Well, as long as I'm doing the proper holistic approaches for me, then I keep my memory. Age, years do not create ill health, either in animals or people. Nothing is because my pet is getting older. Nothing is because I'm getting older. It's only because we're not healthy. There may be a slight less resilience that we may have to be more careful about how we keep ourselves healthy. But it truly is not because of the years. It is simply because of ill health.
So we might be a little bit slower to bounce back, but we will. You know, like if you think about your skin's resistance, then it gets a little worn and older and tired, but it will repair.
But it only is slow to repair if we're not doing the proper things for our diet, our environment, etc. If we're doing what's right for us, even 100-year-olds can repair very quickly.
I think the answer to the question is follow Christina Chambreau's attitude about life. That is, if it's totally positive and she believes in the spiritual world as the essence and what the foundation and what gives you your drive and ability to heal, I think this is where it all comes from. That's why I love talking to you.
Great. Well, you know, it's so true. if we make an assumption that the years age us, there's nothing we can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if we make the assumption that our choices age us and create problems for us, then we have total control.
What is aging us? Our what?
Our choices.
Our choices. Is that what you said? Okay.
Yes. So if we choose to live in a house that's full of wireless, that's full of radio frequency caused by smart meters and Wi-Fi and phones with remote handsets where that you can carry the phone around with you,
uh-huh.
Cell phones that are hooked up all the time and searching all the time, if you're sensitive to RF and you make a choice to live in that environment, then you're going to get sick, whether you're a middle schooler or whether you're 80 years old. It doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
There were three children. A classroom last year got wired for Wi-Fi.
Uh-huh.
And because of how the waves bounce around, not everybody in the classroom gets the same amount of radio frequency, and which is electromagnetic. In our bodies, we have minerals. There's iron in our bloodstream, and then heavy metal toxicity caused from vaccines and toxins in the environment. And metals attract magnet, and then the magnet brings along the electricity, and it messes with our cells. So three of the children during that school year developed severe heart disease. Now, that's because they had a vital force sensitivity to the electromagnetic, and they had a vital force weakness in their heart area. But at age 10 or 11, you shouldn't be getting heart disease. So they did get heart disease. One of them, they were all put on meds. One was scheduled for surgery. And their parents that summer got rid of all Wi-Fi in the house and all RF in the house, and the child completely recovered.
This is an amazing story.
This is about our choices in life.
Uh-huh.
When somebody,
but not everybody knows about what you're talking about.
That's right. Absolutely. So that's why this show is so critical, because you're educating people about a wide range of different things. We're educating people about the perspective of homeopathy. The principle and the philosophy of homeopathy would 100% guide you in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hahnemann says, take the case in an unbiased way. That means sit down and look at your life in an unbiased way, or have somebody else look at your life and listen to what they have to say.
Who can do that in an unbiased way?
Well, you do it the best you can, and you become mm-hmm. aware of your biases.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you're trying your best, you're going to do better than if you don't try.
mm-hmm.
So you try to look at your life in an unbiased way. So it's like whatever happens, you try to look at the bigger picture. So I have had, you know, amazing healing over the last year and a half. I was unable to go up steps without dragging myself up, holding onto the stair rail. I'm going to have to get my years straight here as I start telling this story more. But about eight uh-huh. years ago, I started going downhill and having trouble walking, et cetera. And a few years into it, I discovered I had bone-on-bone left hip and stenosis in my back, and actually went in looking for a hip replacement. And the nurse, as she walked me back, said, you're walking awfully well to be looking for a hip replacement. And
yeah.
she put up the x-ray and said, oh, I see why you want one.
Why?
Because it was bone-on-bone left hip.
And how were you walking so well with this?
Because I was doing homeopathy and acupuncture and Chinese herbs and physical manipulation, and the list went on. I was
uh-huh.
doing whatever I could. And then I started working with a channeler who channeled advice from my team of healers. And they turned me on to some of the things I was still doing were needed, but we added in a man who does a unique form of shiatsu. And within a year, last winter, I skied, I was folk dancing, I was biking, I was back to doing everything that I always wanted to do, and I did not get a hip replacement.
Wow. We're going to have to follow the story.
Well, here's the next piece of the story, which is right where we are talking about, is I flew, this is wonderful and also challenging. So I scheduled with my husband and two friends a week with the four of us in Kauai.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was staying for another 10 days, staying with friends who live there. And I got to Kauai. I was having a little more trouble walking the last month or so, and my channelers had told me to go to a different healer, which I had done, but only had had one session. I got off the plane in Kauai, and I could hardly walk again. I went for a horseback ride, and I was in pain. I recuperated after a day. The next day, I was having trouble walking again. I wasn't able to walk on the beach really well. I mean, I wasn't back to dragging myself up the stairs anymore, but I was definitely not in good shape. So I stepped back and in an unbiased way looked at what could be causing it. So one possibility was the plane ride. Yeah, it was 20 hours.
Okay, that's a good reason.
Sitting on a plane, sitting in an airport. Well, yeah, but nobody else was lame from it. So mm-hmm. that was a possibility. And as an unbiased observer, that's one thing you would observe. Another mm-hmm. could be there was something going on the island.
Mm-hmm.
Another, I don't know. And now that I'm home, having been in beautiful, wonderful Kauai that I love and feel grounded and love being there, the instant I got home after an even longer flight coming back because I missed my plane, I'm not having any pain.
Okay. Well, how do we figure this out?
I don't know. The only thing I've come up with so far is it prompted me to have a healing session while I was in Hawaii, and a bunch of Hawaiian healers stepped in and worked on my heart. So maybe I was in pain to trigger me to call some healers to get a deeper healing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way that you're explaining that from my perspective is each person, whatever happens in their life, it happens for a reason, but only that individual themselves can interpret it and hopefully interpret it in a positive light.
Yes.
Because it's easy to say something negative about whatever's happening, but if we always turn it around and find the good in it, it's going to help us.
Absolutely. And that's one of the obstacles to cure is having a bias. And we see that a lot in animal cases, particularly with specific breeds. So and this even goes to good homeopathic veterinarians may talk about it this way. And we even joke about it with people. We'll say the British remedy. So what of all the homeopathic remedies would we say British people are?
Now, you've got me there. You're saying the British remedy for what?
For people, for British people. How do you know, it's like when you take a personality sort of thing, you say, what is the quote, typical British person like? They're fairly introverted and private and put up walls against connecting. That's like the typical picture of a British person. Totally untrue for everybody, but that's like this picture of them. And so you look at Natrum Muriaticum.
Oh.
The typical American is works too hard, drinks too much, plays too hard, is pretty reactive and irritable, but can also be very nice. So the, quote, American remedy is Nux Vomica.
Oh, I'll take some of that.
Now, that is so untrue that everybody in America needs Nux Vomica and everybody in England needs Napmure, right?
I think you're right, because we need to look at each person.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's true when people talk about animals. They say, oh, Labrador retrievers all need Calcarea carbonicum, because so many labs are easygoing. they'll sort of get stuck in what they want to be doing and have to be dragged away from it. They
They're often
overweight. They have thyroid disease. So you think, well, every lab needs Calcarea carbonicum. Well, obviously that's not true. Jersey cows. People say, oh, Jerseys are so sweet. And it looks like they're sad, the coloration of their eyes. So they need pulsatilla. Christopher Day did an entire lecture, an all-day lecture on personality types of different species and different breeds. So even excellent veterinarians will slip sometimes into that. And it's a way of learning your materia medica to think about it from that approach, as long as you don't base your thinking on it. So,
but
for instance,
I had a comment about like breeds. Don't certain breeds, when they have weaknesses in particular organs, then you might look at a group of remedies that have an affinity toward those organ systems.
Well, that's absolutely the key, as you said, group.
Okay.
And also, if the other piece of this, in terms of having an unbiased observation and not thinking of remedies for types or that every animal is a certain way, can also apply to things like heat or cold. You would sort of think that a black cat would seek cool rather than heat. And yet I've known of a black cat that would sun itself on a shiny metal roof until it was literally panting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have a dog with a really thick coat, like a husky, who's from the north, and they really like to lie out in the snow, you will put less weight on that symptom than you would if you had a husky with a really heavy coat who absolutely wouldn't go out in the snow and had to be inside in front of the wood stove baking. You know, you would pay a little more attention. You would put more weight on that symptom.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely knowing personalities can help. So one person wrote us about a cat with a behavior problem, and she says that she is a tortie, and apparently their brains, like any cat wired up like hers is, cannot recognize their owner as not an intruder that needs to be chased off. Well, that's more specific than I've ever heard about torties, but torties do have this reputation for being crazy.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, they do.
Oh.
I mean, they do have a reputation for being crazy and sort of weird and sort of a little cantankerous or irritable. However, just because a cat is a tortie, you don't assume that that is a normal behavior. Mm-hmm. So if you have a cat who's a tortie and has other problems and has emotional problems and other problems or has any problems and you're treating them, you wouldn't be surprised if, when everything else is cured, if the cat still acts a little crazy.
Okay, I really do have a question about all of this, because when you say the cat is crazy or a person is crazy, that's not enough for me personally to, I don't have a rubric to look under. What is the actual behavior that's going on?
But the point I'm making is, whatever the slightly excess behavior is, which you know, however they're expressing it, if that's still present after you feel that you've cured the case, and it's just saying that torties do tend to be that way, so it may not completely go away.
Okay.
A yellow lab, who's just has plenty of energy but is not going to run circles around you on a walk, the lab could go for a long time, and they might trot a little bit, but they're pretty much going to behave and stay on the leash beside you. Mm-hmm. That's a, you wouldn't necessarily see that go away. That's not something that will change. They're not going to change from a lab into a Jack Russell Terrier. A Jack Russell Terrier who's full of energy and dashing all over the place and looking into everything and figuring out what's going on and, oh, my goodness, what's going on, mm-hmm. isn't going to become a lab when they're cured. They're still mm-hmm. going to have that behavior. But it's what is abnormal would be too much of that. So when you have a cat who actually attacks you, you don't say, oh, that's just normal torty behavior.
Mm-hmm.
If a cat or dog attacks you or attacks other people, that is too much. That is an energy imbalance. That's a vital force imbalance.
And even in a pet or in a child, we would say this behavior is unacceptable.
Exactly.
I would
and
say that in my house.
And mm-hmm. it's a vital, and sometimes it's training, but usually as, I mean, you have to pay attention to training, but once you rule out that training's been done properly or that the behavior is still just so outrageous that it's not about training, then you know that the vital force is ill and you need a homeopathic remedy to cure the animal. Or you need great traditional Chinese veterinary medicine or Reiki or flower essences, maybe not just rescue remedy, although it helps often. It's not a panacea. So you need to find the right treatment. Mm-hmm. And since we're doing homeopathy here, we're focusing on the homeopathy. And some of my colleagues feel homeopathy will treat everything. In my hands, I've not always been successful in homeopathy, and in my own personal healing journey, homeopathy has not been the be-all and end-all. Some people have, if you think of a palette of colors, a painter's palette, and you put colors on it,
mm-hmm.
the palette is what's available to treat people. And then you have a canvas that you're going to paint on, and the canvas is you, or your dog, or your cat, or your horse, or your child. And some people and animals just need one color to stay healthy. You can use just conventional medicine, and they stay healthy their whole life. You can use just homeopathy, and they stay healthy their whole life. Others need to have a palette that's full of different paints. You need lots and lots of different colors to keep them healthy.
Well, this is one of the wonderful things about talking with you is that we're not restricting ourselves to one form of therapy, that
right.
we do have so many other tools in our toolbox, and this is a broad scope which helps us to know each person is a little bit different. Even Dr. Adel, who will be on in the next hour, talks about using physical massage to move the heart, to help the heart. If the heart is unable to pump itself, that
right.
you have to keep things flowing. And meditation and yoga, which he introduces into all of his classes. So it's
there
wonderful
you go.
To talk with you.
However, what I would say is that the principles of homeopathy cover everything. If you just don't insist on it being a homeopathic remedy, all the other principles are accurate, regardless of what modality you're using. So understanding obstacles to cure can be a real key. One of the obstacles to cure is poor diet for people or for animals. So I had a blood test done, and I had antibodies against cow and goat dairy products, chicken and duck eggs, wheat and buckwheat.
This is for you?
Yeah.
Wow. But
now,
you live on a farm. You get all of these wonderful products.
Right. I mean, I don't live on a farm, but I live in a farm area, and I've been eating it organically and raw milk and doing what I thought would have been great.
Uh-huh.
And yet for me, I have antibodies for those. Now, my personal opinion is that if you're cured with homeopathy or other holistic methods, those antibodies will go away.
Okay.
But an obstacle to cure might be to not eat those for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly an obstacle to cure for some people, like some autistic kids, if you just get them off sugar or high fructose corn syrup, which is full of GMOs and pesticides, they're cured completely. While others try that and it doesn't help at all.
Right.
So
they're
using
the deceased diet and all and removing.
Well, all of that works for some and not for all.
Or you might get a little partial improvement.
You might get some improvement, but not complete.
Mm-hmm.
But diet is always one place to look. And Hahnemann, of course, talks about diet. Now, for him, eating vegetables was an obstacle to cure.
Yeah, I kind of worried about what a lot of things that he told us to stay away from. Garlic? I mean, we need garlic. Can't live without garlic.
Well, maybe, maybe not. But, you know, I love garlic. I can't live without it. I'm glad I didn't have antibodies against garlic.
Uh-huh.
But you have to put everything like that that's very specific into the context of his time. He also said in the Organon that chess was too mentally stimulating and therefore an obstacle to cure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this day and age, chess is not mentally stimulating compared to some other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
you do have to put him. He was saying that what he was saying is that these vegetables had an herbal influence on the body and therefore interfered with the homeopathic treatment. And we do know that sometimes you can take a remedy, you can be seeing improvements, and then you do a session of essential oils with a massage that you get and don't even think about it. And you're, not everybody, but some people, their progress is stopped.
Oh.
Because sometimes, you know, strong odors may stop the progress or may interfere with homeopathy. So, or using peppermint toothpaste or having your teeth worked on, or there are all sorts of things that might interfere, but it's a unique for each individual. It's not a rule across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I find is with most people, the more they eat processed foods, the less healthy they are in general, although it's not true for everybody. And even more so, I find that true for animals, for dogs and cats. And horses, actually. But with dogs and cats, feeding processed food is probably, in some animals, is an obstacle to cure. And particularly with cats, no cat should ever eat dry food. Now, having said that, there's a woman who runs a behavior listserv, and she strongly, fervently, absolutely, positively believes that cats are insect eaters and nibblers, and therefore they need to have dry food out free choice all the time. And her cats are on that diet, and they live to be 20 to 22.
Mm-hmm.
So is it her belief system that attracts cats to her who thrive on...
I just lost your sound for some reason. Hello?
But it's...
Hello? Christina, I don't know what just happened, but I just lost your sound for a moment. So just repeat the last
sure.
sentence.
So I don't know if it's this woman attracts cats who do okay on dry food or and don't get kidney problems because they're living to be 20 to 22 on dry food free choice. But in general, even conventional veterinarians, particularly at the internal medicine level, are saying dry food has come back to bite us.
Mm-hmm.
Dry food stresses cats, keeps them dehydrated, and puts a big stress on their kidneys. So we often get kidney disease. So therefore, I would say cats should never have dry food. Now, whether they're on fresh or processed, fresh is certainly better. It's better for the environment and better for the dog or the cat. Horses, likewise, it's better to not do processed food, and processed food for horses would be pellets, and you just don't know what's going in it, so it's not totally safe, and you want to feed hay in a way that makes them use their lips and their teeth. So you want to feed hay in a hay net. So there are, you want to try to approximate what is the natural diet. Just like the books that have done that with people, like Eat Right for Your Blood Type, you're mm-hmm. trying to approximate your natural diet for you. And some people find great benefit with that. So some people who might have an animal with behavior problems can just switch the cat on to fresh food and the behavior problems completely go away. Other cats, other people with cats with behavior problems need homeopathy or Chinese medicine or an animal intuitive to work to talk to their cat. There was one cat I know that was peeing all over the house. Now, there were four cats, young cats, that had been born there, and there were three cats who were originally there, plus the mama cat. So it was now a townhouse with a lot of cats. But when talking to an intuitive, the intuitive figured out which cat it was, and the cat said that he didn't smell very well, so he felt he had to mark. And she said, mm-hmm. well, that really doesn't work. You're safe there, you don't have to mark, and it makes your owner very unhappy. So he stopped marking.
Just now, by doing what? Just by telling the cat?
Yes, just by talking to the cat.
Okay. Now, see, you're way beyond me. I wish
and
you
I've seen
through.
And I've seen that happen frequently with behavior issues that you mm-hmm. can just there was a bull, Penelope Smith, I think it is, talks about this in her book. There was a bull that was hand raised because, you know, his mother died or something like that, and so he was a pet. And as he got bigger, at some point they sort of said, well, I guess he's a bull now, we'd better put him down in the bullpen. And mm-hmm. he became this mean, nasty, tearing up the fence kind of a bull. And they called an animal communicator, and he said, I belong near the house. I'm not a bad guy. I'm family. I need to be in that pasture by the house. And as soon as they moved him up to the house, he became this nice, sweet, docile bull that would still mount the cows and do his job. But he was part of the family. And it took just talking to him to find that out. Does it work all the time? No. Is it worth trying? Yes.
Well, you know, I'm doing the 21-day meditation series with
Deepak Chopra.
Deepak Chopra,
yeah,
and
I've
Oprah.
Done that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you've done it already? Well, today
I did the first one. They're on their second one now.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
I did the first one.
I didn't know about the first one. Well, I'm on the second one, and today's was day three was intuition, using your intuition. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about, using your intuition.
Well, it is. And sometimes in terms of obstacle to cure, our intuition is very biased. So sometimes we haven't learned yet to really closely listen to our intuition so we can ask somebody else. Or if an animal is very ill, it's hard to be unbiased enough to truly listen. So by asking somebody else to tune in, they can sometimes give us an answer we can't get ourselves. So it's just asking for some help.
I think asking for some help is one of the greatest lessons of life for everyone. I'm serious. I get this message quite a bit. People who are afraid to ask for help or stubborn or don't realize that's all they need to do is just ask, and then something's going to change and something will happen in their life to receive. Otherwise, you're thinking it's all within your own power to do everything, where in reality we need each other.
Yes, absolutely. I was actually talking to a man on the plane who was just tickled with this, and he said, he's in the Republican hierarchy and stuff, and he said, I think I'm going to have the Republican Party take this on. And mine was, adopt a family. If every one of us adopted one other person or one other family as ours, as our family,
mm-hmm.
then everybody in the United States would be partnered up and have somebody taking care of them and watching out for them and empowering them.
How can we do this? How can this happen? I mean, I understand, you know, we have our organizations where you can adopt a pet.
Right.
And maybe this is where you got this idea from. I don't know.
No. I've just, I read somewhere, probably in my work with the Hunger Project, something about if your sister was starving to death, if your sister didn't have a job, if your sister were ill, you would work with her until it was taken care of and handled.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody, if they had a sister that could empower them, or a brother or a family or whatever, would be taken care of. And I thought, wow, you know, every time I look at any issue in Baltimore City, pollution, bad schools, da-da-da, drugs, da-da-da-da-da, it's like, if I could work with, and it'd have to be an appropriate match, but if I could have somebody, and I've done this, we've actually done this before, and so there are some challenges about doing it, for sure. It's like the Big Brother, Big Sister program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's adopting another person in the Big Brother, Big Sister. You have rules that you follow, and you don't do too much, et cetera, but it works probably 80% of the time.
So how can we get this started? Well, I guess just right now on the show.
Just talking about it.
By the idea.
Yeah, there are tons of programs out there. So it's like, mm-hmm. if you aren't already doing that, do it. Find a way. Through churches, there are all sorts of ways. I tend to do it on a larger scale than just one family. But, mm-hmm. you know, I my 60th birthday party, I invited my friends over to celebrate my birthday by making 450 sack lunches for one of the soup kitchens.
You're amazing. That's a great idea.
On my 50th birthday, I invited people to come down to Habitat for Humanity in Baltimore, and we worked for one day doing anything they told us to do. We had about 40 people, and in one day, my 40 friends cleaned out two backyards, which meant, you know, big hunks of concrete and bricks and used syringes and condoms and bottles. And we painted the inside of, I think, 1.5 houses, framed a bathroom, installed a staircase to the basement, because some of my people were very skilled. I think that was about it, but that was pretty good for a day's work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think
you need to inspire a lot more people.
Well, that's what all this is about. You know, I talk about it to everybody. So my seatmate, like I say, was somebody, he's in mental health, and he was in George Bush's administration, and he still has a lot of contacts, and he said, that's a really good idea. So who knows where it'll go?
It's one person's idea and another person's leadership on another
mm-hmm.
person who's going to lend a hand and be inspired. And
that's right.
All of those, it's like a recipe for healing.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to talk about any of the other obstacles to cure?
Yep,
or would you
absolutely.
Like to...
The next obstacle to cure is vaccination.
Okay.
So particularly with aggressive animals, vaccination is, particularly the rabies vaccine, will create aggressive animals. If they're susceptible to the vaccine and have a weakness in that behavioral mode.
Mm-hmm.
But even if they're not susceptible particularly to one vaccine, they could be susceptible to the adjuvants that are in the vaccine, which are often metals, which could cause heavy metals to be stored in their liver, which could make them more sensitive to these microwave frequencies that we have all around us that are being attracted to our bodies. So if your animals, one of the questions we always ask as a homeopath, someone comes in and says, my animal has been having diarrhea for the last 4 months and off and on. And you go, well, what happened 4 months ago? Was there, and we have this list of questions we tend to ask, and each one is different, and that's why if you're unsuccessful working with one practitioner, go to another one, because they may have a different perspective and ask a different question that all of a sudden opens up the cause of the problem. So no one person has it all by any means. Even the best homeopaths may fail, and some other homeopath may succeed. So I ask about, did you get new furniture? Did you do new painting? Did you change laundry detergents? Did you get a new dog or cat bed? Did you get some new cat toys? Did you change the diet? Did they get vaccinated? Have they been given heartworm prevention or flea treatment? I was visiting a relative of mine, and there was this incredible outgoing cat. He'd run around the yard. He would jump the fence at the gate and go across the street to the beach that was right next door. And no pets allowed at the beach, but this cat was allowed because he brought himself in and made himself friends with everybody. And the day I was there, the pet walker came back and said, "Everybody at the beach is wondering where Joey is. He's not there." So they went looking for Joey, and he was like flat out lethargic, laying under a bench. So they asked me to come look at him, and I did. And the first thing I noticed was sort of some grease on his neck. And I was just touching it and sort of trying to figure out what it was. And my relative said, "Oh, I just put some Frontline on him," or something like that on him. She said, "I only do it occasionally, maybe two or three times a year when I see him itching." Well, number one, never treat for fleas just because they're itching. Wait till you make sure there are fleas there. Just like never give them a worming medication unless you actually have a stool sample done and you know what you're treating for. Don't give herbs for worms if there are no worms there. And so I immediately assumed this was it. Now, this cat had gotten this off and on for 5 years and had never been sick. This time, it was the wrong moment, and the cat was profoundly sick from it. So I got Dawn dish detergent, which they happen to have, but a dish detergent, dish detergent, and I scrubbed up his neck and wiped off his neck. I happened to have Rescue Remedy with me. I gave him Rescue Remedy orally, put it all over his body. I did Reiki on him, and within 15 minutes, he was up, he was walking, he walked to the gate, but he couldn't jump it. So I opened the gate from him, and he walked across to his beach.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, even though he had had something before, this made him ill. I had a cat I treated for asthma. It was not until the fifth year of getting vaccines that he had a profound asthmatic attack, and then was sick for a year and a half on medications till he came to me, and Thuja cleared it up. Thuja and Silica are the two remedies listed for asthmatic respiration or asthmatic coughing after vaccinations, although other remedies might be needed to cure. This time it was Thuja. And so you never know. Just because something's been done before doesn't mean that it can't be causing the problem this time. And now I'm adding to my list, when I ask people, have they been vaccinated? Have you had new furniture, et cetera? I am now asking, have you added new wireless to your home? Have you added a hand-free phone? Has your electric meter been changed from an analog meter with those discs that circle around? Has it been changed to a digital meter or to a smart meter? The new smart grid that they're trying to press on us and push on us and have sneaked by both at the federal level and the state level is thousands of times stronger and more damaging to people and to animals. So that's another question I'm now going to be asking. I'm going to be suggesting that people right now immediately go outside and look to see what kind of a meter they have. If they no longer have a meter that has the little wheels that go around, they need to contact their electric company and ask for it to be replaced, whatever they have, to be replaced with an analog meter.
Will they do that? Because I saw...
It depends on the state. Mm-hmm. And if they won't do it, then you have to go online and do a Google search for your state. So Maryland Smart Meter Opposition. And you'll be connected with the people that know how to do it.
Uh-huh.
In Maryland, I can opt out.
Oh, great.
In Kauai, where I was living, or where I was for 17 days, at this point, you can still opt out, and legally you can get it replaced. Now, when people call, they're given all sorts of stories about, no, it can't be, no, it can't be. But if they push the issue, they replace it.
Mm-hmm.
Other states have lawsuits going.
Yeah, I've seen quite a bit about them, about families who are, you know, there. I don't know whether they've been arrested. The people have been arrested, but I was watching a number of videos all about it.
Well, if people, so many people are severely damaged from them, get very bad headaches, they can't even work. Therefore, you can get an ADA form, American Disabilities Application, and you take that to your employer or you take it to the electric company and say, I can no longer live in my house, so I fall under the Disabilities Act, and it forces them to change it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are multiple ways that you can work around it. But it, again, it's taking responsibility for our health and for our animals' health.
We constantly have new things to be concerned about.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the article that I saw, it was on Natural News, and it was, you know, Mike Adams. It was called Smart Meters, Homeowners, Police. And I'll give those folks who are on the chat today, we have quite a few people checking in with us.
Oh, good.
That link. And if anybody has a question, you're definitely welcome to comment on the chat.
Yep, we've got another 15 minutes, so if they get their questions in right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've pretty much answered the questions. There's one more that I wanted to answer for the woman who sent her question in. You might want to post the little bit that I put in about vaccines. So she asked about vaccination and doing titers. And the bottom line with vaccines and titers is there are two approaches to protecting against disease. One is to build your natural health, and then you get natural immunity. With my daughter, I exposed her to chickenpox rather than giving her the chickenpox vaccine. It took about 4 exposures before she finally got chickenpox, but I was able to avoid the chickenpox. Measles, we weren't able to. My husband and I had gone ahead and vaccinated her for measles when she was younger because I wasn't as concerned as I am now. So some people elect to not vaccinate, especially homeopathic people, and that's why I'm saying it on this call, where I might not say this on a radio show that's talking just to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many people in the homeopathic community who are not vaccinating their children or waiting until their children are just ready to go into school and then vaccinating them because they've had a chance to build a good immunity and become healthy, whereas at 1 day of age when they require the hepatitis vaccine, that's ridiculous to give a child a vaccine at a day of age where they're not going to be infected until they are in high school if they do unsafe sex or drugs. So to give hepatitis to a child in the hospital should not ever be done. With animals, what I suggest is one of two things. Either have a good homeopathic vet who you're working with, so that you can expose your animal, your puppy or your kitten, and then if they get sick, your homeopath can treat them. That's the very, very best. For people who are a little more concerned, and even some homeopathic veterinarians and holistic veterinarians like Gene Dodds and Ron Schultz recommend that you give a few puppy and kitten vaccines only with the effective vaccines, which are the viral ones. So that means for dogs, distemper and parvo, and for cats, cat distemper, which is called panleukopenia. Those would be the only vaccines to give, except legally you have to give rabies to dogs, and in most states you have to give rabies to cats. So you can do those basic puppy or kitten ones, and then a few months later, or if you've done no vaccines, to be on the safe side, you could do a titer, which is having blood drawn and tests done either by Gene Dodds, Cornell, or I think Kansas does the test, to check for antibodies against specific diseases. Once you've done the test one time, you do not need to repeat it year after year after year. We don't do it at all for people, so it's sort of silly to do it for animals. But once you've done it once, even if the titer drops down, you have cell-mediated immunity. And according to Ronald Schultz, who's the head of the Department of Immunology at the University of Wisconsin Veterinary School, once you have the titers at just one time, then cell-mediated immunity is always there. So you don't need to repeat the titers. However, since the titers cause no health damage,
mm-hmm.
it's perfectly okay if you're required to get a vaccine to be a pet therapy dog, to be in a show, to do dog classes, to do cat agility classes, that you can get a titer in lieu of getting the vaccine. People
right.
say, oh, I have to get Bordetella for my dog to board my dog. Well,
mm-hmm.
Ron Schultz lectured and to a colleague club, and I heard him, and he said, don't let groomers, veterinarians, and kennel owners force you to poison and kill your animals.
Mm-hmm.
So you can listen, everybody, to my past talks on vaccines where I go into much more detail, but that's the bottom line. Use titers just once unless they're needed to get you out of instead of vaccinating. Don't be forced into vaccinating and stay legal with your rabies vaccine. If you're going to a holistic veterinarian, they are often able to help you have the vaccines not be as harmful for your animals. And there's a wonderful vaccine website, it's on a Yahoo group. It's a Yahoo group. So you go to
mm-hmm.
Yahoo groups and you look for no vax K9, I think, even though it's for cats. No vax
K9. I'll look it up. I know you mentioned it in a previous talk with us, and
yep.
I'm sure I put it on one of our archive notes.
Yep.
You know, what you're saying reflects exactly what you were talking about earlier in the show, where this you found this cat that was living at the beach was full of energy and friendly and everything else, and the day that it became lethargic was the day that something, a type of treatment they've had for so
yes.
many years, never affected them. So you never know when it's the cumulative effect of something is going to cause a sensitivity or a reaction. So wouldn't that make sense for something that's injected into the body as well, especially for the ingredients that are in these vaccines are cumulative?
Well, the effect can be cumulative, but
mm-hmm.
it can also be not so much that it was cumulative, but it was just given at a time when this animal was more susceptible.
Uh-huh.
So one of the issues is it says in the pack in the vaccine package not to get to only give to healthy animals.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people give them even when animals are ill. A lot of veterinarians give it to very ill animals. So maybe this cat was having a little bit of a low time, and because of that was why it became
mm-hmm.
ill. It wasn't because it was a cumulative effect. It
mm-hmm.
was because probably wasn't. It wasn't a vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I sort of doubt that it was cumulative. But
well, I mean, what I'm saying is all of a sudden there would be a sensitivity to something that the cat wasn't sensitive to. So
right.
you're saying it was
sensitivity could have been caused by multiple things.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's sort of the bottom line. Is there multiple different things that could be causing that?
Okay.
And one of the things people can do to help the rabies vaccine not be required as much is to contribute to the Rabies Challenge Fund. Yeah. If you go to rabieschallengefund.org,
mm-hmm.
they're doing a study that as long as they have enough money, they will be able to have it go longer. The more money they get, the longer it will go.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay, I'm going to put that on the chat for the folks. We've got quite a few listeners today, and
nobody else asking questions.
We have. Is there somebody out there who wants to talk? I have two people on the line.
Great. Go ahead.
I see.
Well, I'm finally here, Debbie. It's Marty with the cat.
Great.
Okay, well,
Hi, Marty. We sort of addressed your issues, so let's go on to the other callers first, and if we have time, we'll get back to you.
Right, because I heard most of it, so that was great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so thanks, Marty. And if those folks want to learn more about that cat story, I've got it up on Homeopathy World Community, and I'll put the link for you. Dr. Adil Chimthalawala Kasim is also on the line with us. He's going to be talking in about 5 minutes. And do you have anything you wanted to add to this discussion, Dr. Adil?
Well, I want to ask a question regarding the survival of my rabbits. I have had a pair of rabbits since a year, and every month they reproduce. But they reproduce about 6 to 7 small babies, and all of them die within 2 days, 3 days. The mother does not feed the milk. I take them, I cover them up, clean them, try to feed the milk, but day one, day two, day three, day four, and they die. I don't know what to do with it.
I would be treating the mother rabbit because for not producing the milk. I would be looking at her personality. Any other issues she has, does she change her personality when she's pregnant? Does she change her personality after she's had the rabbit babies? And I'd be thinking, you know, off the top of my head, of Pulsatilla and Sepia, of course.
Okay. Because I'm wondering, initially we thought that the male and the female would be killing the children. So we separated the male after the children were born. And then the mother also kicks them out, and she actually does not want any of the children. So the children are in the cage, then they go away and then they die. But lately we have been realizing that we took out the children, taking care, cleaning them up, and we were giving milk, cow's milk, of course. But I don't know, but they don't seem to survive. This is the 5 days are over, and the first time in practically a year that the babies have survived for 5 days, and now they have died. And now it's becoming painstakingly, every time, it's heartfelt that they keep on dying.
Right,
so mother
absolutely.
Should be treated.
Well, yes. I would start with sepia with the mother for the next litter. And I would also, I'm not expert on rabbit diet, but I'd work with somebody who's expert on rabbit diet. And then with the young ones, it really depends on what their symptoms are as they're failing to thrive. You know, if they're not nursing, then that's one set of rubrics. If they're getting too cold, then like Carbovag, you'd be looking at those. It'd be just
I gave them, this time I gave them Carbovag, but then the biggest problem is the mother does not feed the litters.
Right,
that's why
I'm saying you have to treat the mother.
Okay.
And my first guess would be sepia, but I'd want to take, you know, you need to take the whole case basically.
And how do I send you the case? I mean, how do I observe the mother rabbit?
Right. Well, that's what
that.
You do.
I can give you loads of information about a human being, but how to...
Well, that's one of the challenges that we deal with being a homeopathic veterinarian, is we have to learn how to elicit the symptoms and observe the symptoms. It's sort of like an infant. You know, when you're treating an infant, you have to rely on the parents to give you information on how the infant is acting.
Exactly.
And so that's exactly the same thing. It's no harder to treat animals than it is to treat infants.
Okay. And the next time I was hoping to try Artica urens or something so that lactation would be on. Because I've noticed that she doesn't lactate. But the very fact that the mother discarding her litters, I mean, she just throws them away from her. That's quite heartening to note.
Well, that's why I would say sepia rather than Urtica urens. But I would also be treating her in between. I would be looking for any possible things that are abnormal with her in between. And who I would recommend actually working with is, I'm not expert on rabbits, but there is a Doug Yearout, Y-E-A-R-O-U-T, who specializes, okay. He's a veterinarian, and he specializes in the little critters like mice and rabbits and ferrets and hamsters and gerbils and birds. And he's in Washington State. So if you go to the Academy of Veterinary Homeopathy website, theavh.org, and look him up and drop him an email, then he can work with you, make sure the diet's right, and he'll be able to come up with those obstacles to cure that might be applying to the rabbit.
Thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
Wow, what an exciting discussion. And I found Doug Yearout, veterinarian, is at www.holisticanimaldoc.com. And so you can reach him there. So isn't this fascinating that a homeopathic cardiologist is talking to a veterinarian homeopath and really learning how to take a case?
Well, it's the same thing when I'm talking to a cardiologist. You know, if I have a heart case, I have to go talk to a cardiologist. The Yahoo groups, by the way, is NOVAXK9S.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So it's NOVAXK, the digit 9S.
Right.
To learn about vaccines. Incredible website.
Right. And let me see if I have. I had that. I gave everybody a link to it, and I
Good.
Even have the actual. Yeah, I'm going to give you all the link to everything today. Wow, this is like the biggest resource day of ever, and we have all these people in the chat. So if you have any comments, further comments, we welcome them. Now,
since we're moving on to the cardiology talk, if you want to email your comments, I will respond to the comments by email.
Okay. Do you want to give out your email?
No, just email to you, so we'll keep it in the thing, and you can pass them on to me.
Okay.
And then the other is, remember, Vancouver, British Columbia, May 11th through 24th. Go to my website, My Healthy Animals, to the events. And if you want to learn about homeopathy for animals, if you're an expert or a beginner, there are different courses for each one. And hopefully I'll see some of you in Vancouver.
Yes.
When do you plan to come to India?
In May. Well, I'll come to
India.
You create courses for me and I'll come teach.
Awesome.
Okay.
Oh, awesome. Okay, so now also Dr. Chambreau has All About the Animals Journal. Makes this very easy. One of the prime things that you're going to need to have and learn to do, and that's part of the program, the homeopathy classes, May 11th through 25th in Vancouver, British Columbia. Her website, either ChristinaChambreau.com or MyHealthyAnimals.com. So we're going to say goodbye, and you can hang in there if you like, but we're on to an awesome talk about exotosis, bones, bone health, with Dr. Adil Chimthalo El-Kassim. Would you like me to put on your introduction music, or do you just want to talk?
No, I think we should directly start.
Directly
Dr.
start.
Dr. Christina has already started, and the ball has started rolling, so why not go ahead?
Go ahead.
Have a great talk, guys.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. And ladies and gentlemen, good to come back once again. And we start by a tribute to one of the legends of homeopathy, and that is Dr. Clemens Maria Franz von Bonninghausen. This gentleman was born on 12th of March, 1785, and he left the Heaven for Heavenly Abode on 26th of Jan, 1864. And, what can one say? The glory of the life, dedication, and contributions to homeopathy of Dr. Clemens Maria Franz von Bonninghausen, whom the ordains of destiny had imparted all virtues to be exceptional, excellent, and high in whatever field of activities he decided to take interest. Exactly 162 years ago, Clemens Maria von Franz von Bonninghausen, the late officer of justice to His Royal Highness Louis Napoleon of Holland, lay on a sick bed, and the attending physicians did not know what to do with him. The disease they declared to be suppurative phthisis, that is tuberculosis. Von Boringhausen, hardly 40 years old, suffered exceedingly and believed his death to be near. The doctors concurred. It may well to that patient listen to the suggestion of his friend, the botanist and homeopathic physician, Dr. Weihe, because he was apathetically convinced that he could not get worse anyway and might as well give those funny little pills a trial. The selection of the remedy was made on the basis of a report on his illness, which von Boringhausen himself had compiled in great detail, and apparently with great accuracy, and half a year later, he was hale and hearty once more. So like all many of the legends, Hahnemann, Herring, Clark, and here we have Boringhausen too, Kent also, they have suffered in the past, and because of some remedy acting, a homeopathic remedy acted upon them, and they converted to homeopathy. The attitude of allopathic doctors seems to have puzzled von Boringhausen considerably. Naturally, he had told them how his life had been saved. He had generously offered the secret which would lead to similar successes in their own practice, but was refused politely and otherwise. Westphalian people are said to be strong-headed. The refusal but strengthened von Boringhausen's interest and made him determined to learn more about this therapy, which could pull him back into life when others had given up as a lost case. His intensive studies resulted, apart from many books and treatises, in the final decision to become a homeopathic physician himself and to bring to others the services of this great revolutionary therapy from which he had so greatly benefited. Von Boringhausen was born on 12th of March 1785 at Herringhaven, an estate in the Overijssel, a province of the Netherlands. This state belonged to his father. In his early life, Boringhausen lived in countryside and his body was well-shaped, developed due to riding, swimming and hunting. After attending the school for 6 years at Munster, Boringhausen, at the age of 18 years, entered the Dutch University, where he studied law as well as natural history and medicine. On 30th of August 1806, he received the degree of Doctor Juntrisch Juris, that is Doctor of Law, and on the 1st of October the same year, he was appointed lawyer at the Supreme Court at Denventer. Within a year, he was promoted to the post of auditor to the king, and within 14 days of his appointment, he was made the general secretary. Wow, quite an achievement for this gentleman. Boringhausen remained in Holland and worked on these burdensome posts until the resignation of the King of Holland on the 1st of July 1810. He married in the autumn of 1812 and went to his ancestral estate of Darup in Westphalia. Conversion to homeopathy. In 1827, he became seriously ill and was diagnosed to be suffering from purulent tuberculosis, which took a serious turn by the spring of 1828, and all hopes of recovery were given up. Boringhausen wrote a farewell letter to his friend of botany, Dr. A.V., W.E.I.H.E., of Herrwarden. Weihe was the first homeopathic physician in the whole of the provinces of Rhineland and Westphalia, although Boringhausen was ignorant of it. Dr. Weihe requested an exact and detailed description of the disease and its concomitants, and expressed the hope that he may get well, and so Boringhausen compiled the symptoms in great detail and with great accuracy. Weihe prescribed him Pulsatilla, and with Pulsatilla he gradually recovered, and by the late summer he was cured of his ailment. This was a turning point in the life of Boringhausen and the course of homeopathy in Germany and that part of Europe. Boringhausen became a firm believer and ardent promoter of homeopathy. He was able to convert to homeopathy Dr. Lutterbach and Twisting. His influence, helped, and teaching brought many new adherents to homeopathy in the countries like France, Holland, America, etc. By a royal order dated July 11, 1843, by King Frederick Wilhelm IV, he was empowered to practice medicine. He completed his job of land registry and resigned from Dutch civil service to devote wholeheartedly to the practice of homeopathy. He was in constant correspondence with Hahnemann and disciples of Hahnemann like Staff, Gross and others. He remained physically sound and mentally active till the very old age, but in the winter of 1863 he suffered from bronchial catarrh and he continued to attend his afternoon calls. On Jan 22nd, he completed his written work. After a walk, on 24th of Jan 1864, he suffered a stroke and apoplexy of left side paralysis and died on 26th of Jan 1864 at 3:45 a.m. at the ripe age of 78 years, 10 months and 14 days. Out of the seven sons, two followed his example. His first son, Karl, born on 5th November 1826, started living at Paris and was married to the adopted daughter of Hahnemann's second wife, Madame Melanie. He settled down in Paris and practiced homeopathy in conjunction with Madame Hahnemann. He died on 13 July 1902 with his wife, had died 3 years earlier. Bollinghausen's second son, Frederick, born on April 14, 1828, adopted a legal career, but after passing the first two state examinations, he began to study medicine. At the age of 27 years, he was a very, very delicate child and suffered from blindness for 2 years. He was cured by his father and he did not use glasses even in his old age. After studying medicine for 4 years in Bonn and Berlin, and after passing medical examination, he settled in 1859 as an assistant to his father and likewise practiced homeopathy till death. Homeopathic writings from 1831 to 1908, they were published. Bollinghausen has got literally many, many things, publications to his credit. In 1831, The Cure of Cholera and Its Preventives. In 1832, Repertory of the Antisoric Medicines, a masterpiece every single homeopath should read. 1833, Summary View of the Chief Sphere of Operation of the Antisoric Remedies and the Characteristic Peculiarities as an appendix to the repertory. In 1834, he wrote a manual, Homeopathy, a Manual for the Non-Medical Public. This for homeopaths would seem to be for laymen, but in his times, it was this book, published in 1834, that helped to convert large number of lay people to homeopathy. In 1835, again a masterpiece, he wrote Repertory of Non-Antisoric Remedies. 1836, again a book which in those times and even today is basically not cared for. The subject is not cared for, and he has written as early as 1836. Attempt at Showing the Relative Kinship of Homeopathic Medicines. Now this, ladies and gentlemen...
Say that again. The what?
Attempt at Showing the Relative Kinship of Homeopathic Medicines. That means how one medicine is related to other. For example, Apis and Rustox. What is the relationship at the mental level and the physical plane? Caustic and Phosphorus and many, many more. This, ladies and gentlemen, is again a masterpiece and a must read for all homeopaths who want to develop into art and science of homeopathy. In 1845, he wrote an essay on the homeopathic treatment of intermittent fever, which was translated and edited by Charles Julius Hempel. In 1846, Therapeutic Manual for Homeopathic Physicians. 1847, Therapeutic Pocketbook for Homeopaths to be used at the bedside of the patient and the study of the Materia Medica. Again, this book contains Concordance of Homeopathic Remedies, a very, very important book for serious homeopaths. 1849, he wrote Brief Instruction for Non-Physicians as to the Prevention and Cure of Cholera. 1853, The Two Sides of Human Body and the Relationships. Again, a very, very good, a milestone rather. This book has set up a milestone for future homeopaths. Depending upon the sides, for example, Lachesis is a left-sided remedy and Lycopodium is a right-sided remedy. Now this theme or this flow of thought was set upon by Bollinghausen in 1853 by writing this book, The Two Sides of the Human Body and Their Relationships. In 1854, he did not relent and kept on continuing the writing The Sides of the Body and Drug Affinities, Homeopathic Exercises in 1854. Then in 1860, he wrote something on whooping cough. 1863, The Aphorisms of Hippocrates with notes by a homeopathic pocketbook for homeopathic physicians. And in 1891, Therapeutic pocketbook for homeopathic physicians to be used at bedside and in the study of Materia Medica. Now this was an old book, old wine in new bottle, but that new bottle was far more superior to the old one. It has an American edition by Timothy Field Allen, T.F. Allen, in 1891 again. And 1908, he wrote Lesser Writings. It contains articles written, it was not written by him, it was actually a compilation of all the small works written by Boninghausen. It was compiled by Indian prints and were published. So as late as 1908. So with these words, we salute this master prescriber. Along with Hahnemann and Kent, he is and has been the pillar of homeopathy.
It's a masterpiece of achievement throughout his lifetime that he could have been writing so much every single year.
That's not the only thing. See, he was basically a lawyer and a botanist. And I wonder, I've read his life biography umpteen number of times, and I compare it with my own lifestyle. I've been born and brought up in a homeopathic family. I've been born and, I've done my medical education. I have not wavered anything from homeopathy since my early childhood. And yet, when I compare my life to his, it was hardly 3 years of his entering homeopathy. And he could grasp the subject, the philosophy so well that he could write masterpieces. The very fact that he could write a repertory on which even Hahnemann relied is not less a thing. So he is a great inspirator. You can admire his intelligence, how well one person can grasp the philosophy of a particular subject and develop it to an extent that even the introducer of homeopathy, Hahnemann himself, regarded Boninghausen as a man of substance and would read his works. So this is not a small thing. By no chance it is a small thing.
Really, I think a person has to be very connected to the earth, which you say he was a botanist, to understanding life, growth, the nature of living organisms. And then to have the ability as a lawyer to assess and grasp other aspects of, objectively.
Exactly. See, one would expect that a lawyer would criticize a particular thing, would not accept a philosophy so easily, unestablished philosophy so easily. Although Boninghausen was cured of pulsatilla in a period of time, yes, that's a very, very big thing. But still, the lawyer in him could have easily taken a sarcastic view of the entire pathy, and would have. But on the other hand, Boninghausen did not let it happen. Mm-hmm. He used that intelligence to build up that philosophy and could publish books after books, writings after writings, which even today we follow and are unparalleled even in 2013.
Absolutely. People are using that pocketbook as a major source of the way they practice to understand what he has written so succinctly based on specific principles.
Yeah. So, we have another round of studying rubrics of the chest.
Okay. So I want to let everybody know that we are in an educational study session for the past over a year, and we have been opening our Kent repertory to the chest chapter, and we have gotten all the way to the letter E, and that is, I know, we're finding that we have to have a lot of patience, and we're not going to rush through it, but we're going to go really, what people now call deep diving into the ocean and into these rubrics to understand so much more than if we just skimmed through it. So we've finished eruptions, erysipelas, excoriation, and now exotosis on page 832.
Yeah. And as it is given on page number 832, exotosis on ribs with one single drug, that is Merck-Cor, could have been easily neglected and overlooked, and you can easily go on to the next relevant rubric, and that is fat about the heart with nervous irritability. But exostosis on the ribs is not a rubric to be neglected, as we will see. I have given a PowerPoint presentation for all those I mean, it's a very good PowerPoint presentation. And if you understand what exostosis is, I have taken this rubric on page number 832, and I have also taken the help of another rubric in the chapter of generalities, page number 1405. I repeat, 1405, swelling bones, swelling periosteum, swelling cartilages. And I have clubbed these two rubrics because we can't learn anything about exostosis and ribs only with Merck Core. We have to combine these two rubrics and then learn much, much more about exostosis, what they are, and we can extrapolate the same thing, exostosis on the ribs or exostosis on any other bones, and see what the relevance of exostosis is, how we should approach it clinically, what we can do, can we learn some other remedies, and we can differentiate the relevant remedies when we have such a case. So that is the reason why I wanted to take the rubric and combine generalities chapter, swelling, bones, periosteum, cartilages, page 1405. So we are going to club these two rubrics and then study them together.
Okay.
I hope I'm clear.
Very good. Let me know if you want any quotes today. I have them ready for you.
Yeah. And first of all, what do you mean by exostosis? Many people are not aware of this term. Exostosis basically is in old terminology. We don't use it nowadays in modern medicine, but it basically means a bony growth. I have written it's a benign bony growth, but then the word benign is not to be overemphasized. It's a bony growth projecting outward from a bony surface. This is the pure definition of exostosis. But it may not be benign, it can be malignant also, so the word benign does not pay off. You can have an excrescence or a bony or a growth projecting from the cartilage. So you can have an exostosis cartilagea, a variety of osteoma consisting of a layer of cartilage developing beneath the periosteum of a bone. So that means when the bone arises from a bone, or bony mass arising from a bone, or a nodule arising from the bone, and that is covered with the cartilage, then we have got exostosis cartilagenia. So you don't have a direct nodule from the cartilage, but the cartilage covers that nodule or covers that exostosis, and that is why it can be presenting as exostosis cartilaginea. Then you can have a condition called as hereditary multiple exostosis. Hereditary, self-explanatory, that is, it goes on from father to son or mother to the children. It's generally a benign hereditary disorder of enchondrial growth of bone. En means inside, chondra means cartilage. So inside the cartilage, you can have small spicules of bony growth, multiple places, not only on the ribs, you can have them on the long bones, you can have them on the skull, marked by exostosis near the extremities of the diaphysis of the long bones. Generally on the long bones, like the tibia, the fibula, you can have another femur, the humerus, the radius, the ulna, these are the long bones. The diaphysis means the neck of the long bones. Generally, you can have an exostosis there, but not necessarily. You can also have them on the skulls, you can also have them on the sternum and on the ribs. So while studying exostosis on the ribs, we need to also know about this hereditary multiple exostosis. Well, you can't do much about these things because these exostosis are generally not painful, unless they occur on the calcaneum. Calcaneum is the heel bone that forms the heel. And if that you have got small spicules or exostosis, then it becomes very painful and the pain stays on for days together, months together, even weeks together. You have no surgery, but you have got excellent remedies like Lenempal. You have got excellent remedies like Actia spicata and Aristolochia. These three remedies can be used for calcaneal spur, which is nothing but an exostosis on the calcaneum bone, the bone that forms the heel. And again, a very, very common phenomenon. So, people would ask me, what would your medicines do? For example, if you have given Aristolochia or Lenempal or for that matter, Actia spicata, what are they going to do? Are they going to cut the spicules off or are they going to dissolve the exostosis? No, my dear friends. That place is so tightly, so tight, the fascia around the bone is so wrapped up That is why whenever the patient walks and these exosomes develop, then there's a persistent irritation on the sole. Even if the exostosis stays, remedies like Lead-Impal and all significantly relieve the symptoms of pain, significantly relieve the symptoms of the discomfort which remains. In modern parlance, we call it fasciitis. Itis means inflammation and inflammation of the fascia. Fascia is a thick fibrous covering that covers the calcaneal bone. And moment you have got that spurs, that fascia is irritated, that inflammation can be resolved with homeopathic medicines, and that is more at the most we can do. We can make your life comfortable. But those spicules don't go. Then we have given you two x-rays of exostosis. One is the x-ray of the femur, and you can see a small bulge very clearly, and that is nothing but an exostosis. And on the right side, we have given you another x-ray of the chest, where you can see multiple ribs, and on the first, second, third, and fourth, and fifth rib, you can see an exostosis very clearly along the midline, on the right side. X-ray of the chest, it's an x-ray of the chest of the female, because you can see the breast shadows have been seen, that is why it shows that's a female x-ray chest. And if you count from the top, first, second, third, fourth, and fifth rib, near the midline, you can see a small exostosis. Likewise, on the sixth rib, seventh rib also, you can see exostosis here. So, these are x-ray findings of how an exostosis looks like. So, one may ask, what are the causes of exostosis on ribs? What would you think of when you have focusing on the ribs proper? What would you think of? Then, right from congenital to acquired things, multiple disorders, multiple deficiencies can cause exostosis in the ribs. Congenital diseases like forked ribs. Forked ribs means a bifid rib, the rib which has torn itself, and once the rib has torn itself, the torn part arises from the rib in the form of an exostosis or a bony outgrowth. So you can have forked ribs, you can have rib dysplasia. Dysplasia means non-development of the rib. And if the rib is not completely developed, then you can have small spicules on the rib which has been on a maldeveloped rib, and that is called rib dysplasia. Of course, both of these are congenital syndromes. They don't cause any problems to the person. It's an accidental finding. It's not a clinical finding. It's a finding of the x-ray or a CT scan done for some other purpose, and you find this congenital syndromes. Many congenital syndromes like these forked ribs and rib dysplasia are associated or may be associated with some congenital disorders in major organs like the heart, like you can have holes in the heart or septal defects, or you can have some problems in the liver or the most kidney. It can be, not necessary. Then we can have cervical ribs. Cervical ribs, although asymptomatic, cervical ribs means neck ribs, the ribs starting from the vertebra of the neck. Normally, you don't have the ribs starting from the vertebra of the neck. You have ribs starting from the vertebra of the thorax. So first you have got neck, then you have the thorax, then you have the lumbar region, and you have the sacrum. This is how the vertebral column is formed. But in the last rib, suppose the seventh cervical vertebra gives rise to a rib. It is called as a cervical rib. It's a very common phenomenon. Many females, particularly females more and males less, you find the cervical rib. They're basically asymptomatic, but they can cause thoracic outlet syndrome. Thoracic outlet syndrome. It means thorax is a cage and it has an inlet and outlet. So, near the neck end, the thorax forms and has an outlet from where the vessels from the heart, they go up to the brain. The nerves, they come from the brain to the other organ systems. You have the lymphatic channels, you have the veins, you have the muscles and everything. So there is something called as brachial plexus. Brachial plexus is a bunch of nerves that goes out from the thoracic outlet. And suppose you have an additional cervical rib and an exostosis on the cervical rib, then it irritates the brachial plexus and you have a persistent pain. like cervical spondylosis. Then you can have rib fractures or a bony callus about a healing rib fracture, which can cause exostosis. Then there's something called as eosinophilic granuloma. Eosinophilic granuloma. Granuloma is nothing but a collection of large cells, large blood cells. They collect and they have got, when you see them on a microscope, you find multiple small grains, and that is why they call it granuloma, granules. And eosinophil because they are stained with the color pink. So if they're pink colored granules, then you have an eosinophilic granuloma. It's nothing but an allergy of some sort. And you can have a moth-eaten appearance or poorly circumscribed osteolytic. Osteo means bone and lysis means destruction. So osteolytic lesions on the rib, which on X-ray or CT scan shows in the form of an exostosis. Then we have Page's disease. We have already discussed Page's disease about of nipple. Page's disease is a cancerous condition where you have a cortical thickening. See, any bone would have a cortex, that is the outer covering, and an inner medulla. So the cortex thickens over a period of time and that selected part, and there's a bony enlargement, and you can clearly see a bony spicule or a bony nodosity arising from the cortex and going up. The commonest causes of exostosis on ribs is metastasis. Metastasis means a malignant infiltration from cancer not belonging to the ribs but from somewhere else. The commonest cancers that go or infiltrate the ribs are the breast cancer. You have cancer of the lungs. You have got lymphomas. You have leukemias. These are known to spread to the ribs. Now, these may present as lytic lesions or sclerotic lesions. Lytic lesions, that means the ribs would be eaten up. I mean, you can have when you see a CT scan, you will find that means the ribs, the bony part of the ribs, have a moth-eaten appearance, or they can have a nodule-like appearance, and that is called sclerosis. So metastases are very common, rather the most common cause of involvement of ribs as exostosis. Then you can have primary cancers of the ribs, primary neoplasms or tumors of the ribs. They may be cancerous, they may not be cancerous. You can have an osteochondroma. Osteo means bone, chondra means cartilage. So the inflammation or the growth of bone and cartilage together is called osteochondroma. Or you can have an enchondroma. That means it's a bony growth, but the cartilage is covering that growth, and that is why it's called en. En means inside. Inside chondroma, enchondroma. You can have an osteoblastoma. Osteoblastoma is a frank cancer. You can have a chondroblastoma. Chondroblastoma is a cancer of the cartilage. Very, very rare, but you can have that. You can have an hemangioma. Hemangioma, heme means blood or blood vessels. Angioma means blood vessels. So if the angioma, blood vessels start collecting at one place and they start growing, they can have enostosis or bone islands. Small islands of bones, and they present on X-ray as exostosis on the ribs. Then you can have chondrosarcoma. A chondroma or a chondroblastoma is a benign tumor. It will grow to some extent and then stop. But a chondrosarcoma is the commonest primary cancer of the ribs. And ribs, unfortunately, are one of the favorite areas for chondrosarcomas to occur. Then you can have a plasmacytoma or lymphoma, osteosarcoma. Osteosarcoma, again, the commonest malignancy or commonest cancer of the bones, but then ribs are basically not that much affected. It is the long bones which are mostly suffer from osteosarcoma. Then we have infections. Infections occurring on the ribs or inside the ribs, substance of the ribs, and they showing up as exostosis. Of course, very rare. You can have osteomyelitis. I mean, the infection can be somewhere else. For example, the infection can be in the femur, and the by the blood, the infection has traveled to the ribs, and it has attached to the ribs, that bacteria, and now it's growing inside the ribs. Then you can have a bacterial osteomyelitis. It can be because of a surgery or a trauma or just infections like empyema. Empyema means collection of pus in the pleural fluid. If that pus leaks and goes out and touches the corresponding rib, then you can have the complete infection of the rib. Then rarely you can have fungal infection. Fungal infection, fungus basically is a plant. So it grows. You should have a disseminated disease, for example, in HIV patients or AIDS patients, where you can have fungal infection of the tongue and fungal infection of the, say, lungs or brain. And the infection travels and goes to the chest and bones and the ribs. And there you can have exostosis in the ribs, fungal infection. Generally, acute infections are seen as focal areas of bone destruction, whereas chronic infections like tuberculosis or actinomycosis, etc., may first manifest as periosteal reaction or bone sequestrum. Rib infections in general are often associated with chest wall abscess, and if one sees clearly, you can have cutaneous, that means sinus tracts on the skin. Patients with chronic inflammation of the lung or the pleura, like tuberculosis, have enlarged ribs on the affected side because of chronic reactive periostitis associated with localized hyperemia, and this is very well seen on simple plain X-ray chest PA view. I repeat, patients with chronic inflammations of the lung or pleura like tuberculosis, people suffering from tuberculosis, they may have enlarged ribs on the affected side, and that can be clearly seen on an X-ray. Since we are talking about X-ray and radiology, let us see why on an X-ray, what are you going to see and why are you going to see an exostosis of the ribs because of cancer on an X-ray. As simple logic concludes, as a mass grows and expands beyond the confines of the ribs, it may appear as a vague area of increased opacity overlying the lung. Oblique X-rays help show the typical smooth interface with the lung that indicates the extrapulmonary location of the mass. Because you have to differentiate between if the mass is on the lung or on the rib. Is it coming from the lung and attacking the rib, or it is coming from the rib directly? The ribs underlying any vague area of the increased opacity over the lungs should be scrutinized for destruction of the cortex. So, we have to see where that mass is coming from. If it's coming from the rib proper, or is it coming from the areas around the rib, like the lungs, or the fiber, or the muscle, or the blood vessel, whatever. Now, the first remedy, we are going to discuss about the remedies. The first remedy which has been given in one mark, and that is Merck Cor. Of course, a very, very lesser thought of remedy when we are discussing about exostosis in the ribs. But if the exostosis of the ribs is because of a very, very common disease, at least in India and the developing country, and that is tuberculosis. And if the tuberculosis affects the spine, the vertebra, then you can have a disease called Spott's disease, tuberculosis of the vertebra, and you have got all the glands above the thorax which are swollen. The axillary glands, they are swollen, and the patient gets typical stitches to the side of the chest, whichever that area is affected. The patient prefers to lie on the back with knees drawn up, and there are exostosis of the cartilages of the ribs, showing that tuberculosis has spread not only localized to the vertebra, but it has spread to the corresponding ribs as well. So you can use Merck Cor. Of course, a very, very lesser used remedy even for Pott's disease, because the next remedy is much, much more commonly thought of and used with great benefit, and that is silica. Silica or silica, the master remedy, the drug of choice, the first drug, or rather the second drug to be thought of when we think of tuberculosis. And in silica gives a lot of time in patients of tuberculosis till the entire area is completely destroyed. There's a decay of vertebra. We call this as Pott's spine. And for a long time, one would present a stiff neck or stiffness in the neck, and people would take it as cervical spondylosis. Then there's a persistent dull headache and a gradual increasing painful kyphosis. Normally you have got, the spine has a contour, but if the person keeps on bending at a particular angle, that is called kyphosis. And if the kyphosis is painful, then this is the indication of silicia. Spine is weak, sensitive drafts of cold air with multiple exostoses on thoracic ribs. If you have got an x-ray, multiple exostoses on thoracic ribs, then you should think of tuberculosis and should not hesitate to use silicia. Silica has to be used in potency above 30. It may not be repeated frequently, infrequent repetition, and the repetition can be as late as, say, a week or 2 weeks. For example, I would start with the dose of silicia 30, and after 2 weeks, repeat it, ascend the potency to 200 if the situation demands. And it may take around 3 to 6 months for the entire tuberculosis to go away. And I am a witness to many cases. I am a witness, I repeat, although I practice cardiology, but there are times when I have to also see such patients of tuberculosis. They are complicated cases. They are leftover cases by other homeopaths. And in today's times of AIDS, when we have got multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, that means tuberculosis not responding to the conventional methods of allopathic treatment, then homeopathy has to intervene. Homeopathy can intervene best with silica.
I have a question about the development of the tuberculosis disease itself. Is it slow to develop or quick to develop? And does that help you to choose which remedy you're going to select?
Yeah, it is a very slow-growing disease. It would generally present with vague symptoms like a dull backache. I'm talking about tuberculosis of the spine. A dull backache wherever that spine, that vertebra is affected. Dull backache may continue for a long time. People would disregard it as, cervical spondylosis if it's occurring on the cervical area, or thoracic spine if it occurs in lower lumbar area. One would say that it's a slip disc, or one would call it... But people would not, suspect tuberculosis. Then slowly and steadily over a period of, 1, 2, 3, 4 months, they start noticing that they also have got warmth in the body, especially in the evenings or evening rise of temperature. They may not have a typical fever, but if you put a thermometer, you will not get more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit. At the most, 99 degrees Fahrenheit you can get, but not typical fever. But the patient feels warm. The patient feels hot, and the patient keeps on complaining to his or her relatives that, I feel chilly, discomfort, especially in the evenings. And this is very characteristic of tuberculosis. Again, this continues for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and the patient disregards it. But this
are they feeling chilly, cold, or are they feeling hot?
They feel chilly, but when you touch them, the skin feels warm.
I see.
They themselves have an internal chill. They feel they are unable to tolerate this, the typical chill they would tolerate earlier. They couldn't tolerate, they can't tolerate it now. And this, accompanied with a persistent backache, should arise the suspicion or arouse the suspicion of tuberculosis. Then over a period of time, the pain keeps on increasing, and then you can have a frank paralysis or a frank, depending on the area which is affected, that paralysis of the affected part, great pain, high-grade fever. And that is the time when patients generally come to us. They come in panic. They have neglected for a long time, and that long time can be as old as 1 year. People keep on complaining, but they don't go to a doctor. They don't get themselves tested, or the doctor also many times neglect that it could be tuberculosis. And this is how tuberculosis is. Pot spine needs to be differentiated from another deadly disease, and that is to cancer.
Is there no coughing or something else going on?
No. You may not have tuberculosis of the lungs. It may not go to the lungs at all. It may only be restricted to the bone, or at the most to the corresponding rib if it's on the thoracic area.
So
on
just X-rays, the pain. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just the pain. It's just the discomfort. Not even the pain. Just the discomfort, evening rise of temperature, loss of appetite, the chilliness which one feels, and loss of weight, and not even loss of weight, but you are, the patient appears to be sick. That is very persistent. and one from one phenomena. Doc, I don't know. I am not losing much weight. My appetite also is not much changed. But then in the evening, as evening approaches, I would want to lie down. I would just not want to do anything. My enthusiasm wanes off. I feel sick. Now, this is a characteristic symptom of a tuberculosis patient in the earlier part. The patient does complain, but no one takes heed of the situation.
It sounds like it would be more difficult to diagnose with vague symptoms.
Yeah, but then this is how patients present, and they give you about a year's time.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, when you do an X-ray, if you do a CT scan, you don't find much of these things. I mean, you'll not find a frank tuberculosis unless it has destroyed your vertebra completely. It is only these symptoms. It is only an iota of suspicion on the part of the patient or the part of the physician that can lead to a diagnosis of tuberculosis of the spine.
So if they're going to a homeopath who takes their case holistically and understands what the symptoms are, for instance, this chilliness internally but feels warm to the touch, gives them an appropriate remedy, they may never develop into the disease and you would never know that they had it.
Fine, exactly. That's what I'm saying. With a simple drug like pulsatilla or like silicea, you can actually stop the disease process there and then. And you may not let that person develop into full-fledged tuberculosis. Not only that, but after you finish the symptoms for which the patient has come, they subside. You can give one dose of tuberculinum or a dose of sulfur at the most, and the entire disease is aborted. And you save so much on the economy of the patient. You save so much on the... it's actually a destructive disease. It keeps you paralyzed for a long time. You can't do... not much good happens when you have a destruction of the bone, and that to a vertebral column bone.
So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the best thing that we could do for another person is help them and let them live a full life without pain. And in terms of collecting data, it would be impossible to collect the data to say homeopathy has prevented such named disease because it doesn't develop. And yet we might have thousands of these types of cases.
We do have, but it's, for us, it is statistically impossible to prove because even in those times, even when the time when the patient comes and we only are concerned with the symptoms, and even in those times, a CT scan or an MRI would not show anything, even if you do it. See, that's the sorry part. And in modern medicine, unless you have a radiological proof or a proof, substantial proof, you would not give him therapy or give the patients the therapy. So unless you have an advanced disease, the patient does not deserve a therapy. But for homeopathy, we don't require an X-ray diagnosis. For us, the symptoms are more than enough. And I'm very sure, and why other homeopaths? I have seen many patients of suspected tuberculosis. I call it suspected tuberculosis, and they have been cured by this wonderful drug, silicea. Of course, pulsatilla is another very good remedy, but silica is there definitely.
It's quite amazing. This is truly, homeopathy is truly preventative medicine. When allopathy, conventional Western medicine, says their form of prevention is diagnostic exam, and then they finally see some sort of pathological change, that is when they make their diagnosis, that is already too late. I do not consider that preventative. It's just diagnostic.
Yeah. And even you can't even do surgery. At the most, you have to fuse the vertebra. So you have actually spoiled the life of the entire patient just by not thinking about tuberculosis or not doing about it, even if you have thought about the disease process. Not that the allopaths don't know that this is this seems like tuberculosis. See, every allopath who has worked with bones, who has worked with such patients, would have an immediate suspicion of tuberculosis. But because of the person is bereft of the diagnostic modality, not able to show a particular pathology, you can't administer the remedy. How sad. The patient has to keep on suffering till he or she shows up on a imaging modality. Now, that is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how much time do we have? We have 11 minutes.
Yeah, well, and I would like to finish off another wonderful drug called ferula asafoetida. Asafoetida, we use it I mean, Indians use it left, right, and center as spice, as a condiment,
yes, as
and
a spice.
It tastes very, very good. And for our, I mean, years together, we have been hearing that asafoetida is a wonderful, wonderful remedy for worms. I mean, people would give asafoetida for worms to all small children. Grannies still did to do it.
And how about for the pets? How about for those pets instead of worming?
Yeah, I mean, deworming, first thing you ask any Indian lady who is conservative, you would have asafoetida.
Excellent.
Well, but then asafoetida, ferula asafoetida, is a wonderful remedy for tuberculosis or tubercular-like disorders wherein the periosteum is painful, swollen, enlarged, ulcers affecting the bones and ribs, and they discharge ichorous pus. Left to itself, the bones would decay. There's a persistent spasmodic tightness of a chest, as if the lungs could not be fully expanded, and neuralgia of the area persisting after surgeries. But what is important is, ferula asafoetida has multiple exostoses on the ribs. And unfortunately, it is not mentioned anywhere other than the Materia Medica of Kent himself. It is not mentioned in the repertory of Kent on page number 832. It should have been. Now, one very important thing is neuralgia of the area persisting after surgeries. And this is a very common phenomena. Doc, I have been operated. I went to a particular doctor for pain. He did surgery for a particular part. He took off that ulcer. He took off that boil. He did surgery of that area. But after that surgery, there is a persistent discomfort, a persistent pain, and I can't get rid. My doc, that surgeon, says that over a period of 3 months or 4 months or 5 months, that area would go away. He has given me painkillers, but nothing is responding. What do I do? Do you have something in homeopathy? Yes, my dear. We have not one, but two drugs, ferula asafoetida and allium sepa. These two are specific remedies for neuralgia of the area, the neuralgia persisting after surgeries.
Is this what we call ghost pains?
Yeah, exactly. These are nothing but ghost pains. And these pains are very terrible because they don't go. They remain persistent. And people call them psychic. They are not psychic. Mm-hmm. The patient is actually, feeling the pain. But he or she can't say. I mean, everything is not psychic.
Mm-hmm.
And you give few doses of asafoetida, few doses, and I mean literally say few doses. Because after few doses, that pain, whoops, it vanishes. It's gone.
This is marvelous. And you think about all of the veterans out there who have lost limbs and are suffering from this. I have put up on Homeopathy World Community maybe 1 or 2 years ago an entire article about the use of mirrors to reflect one good limb to the other, which has missing a part, and how this is actually in the mind changes the person's ability to feel or not to feel this ghost limb. Have you seen that article?
Unfortunately, no, but then I will now after the interview is over.
I will search it out for you and send it to you. It's a marvelous therapy where you are looking in a box and you either put your hand, your arm in, and you look at the reflection as if you have two whole limbs, even where one is missing, just due to the mirror reflection. And the mind somehow is able to remove the pain that was in that missing limb.
How wonderful, how wonderful. Without medications, it is just your own mind, your own nature healing you. It's beautiful. Then we have another wonderful remedy, Aurum Metallicum. And yes, a master remedy for bones, so why not for ribs? It has been mentioned in the generalities chapter. And in it, there's pain as if there were a plug placed under the ribs. A specific line is written in Aurum Metallicum. Pain as if there were a plug placed under the ribs. Aching in the left side of the chest, aggravated by ascending and aggravated at night. Yes, Aurum Med being a typical syphilitic remedy, all its aggravations of the pains are at night. exostosis in the ribs and bones with soreness, and decay of the ribs, nasal, palatine, mastoid bones. Now this Auramed basically is a remedy for advanced pathological cases for tuberculosis or other granulomatous diseases like eosinophilic granuloma or metastasis, wherein the cancer is basically controlled. But the metastasis which had spread to the ribs are now a persistent source of pain because of decay of the ribs. And in such a situation, you need to give aurum metallicum. In fact, I have a patient who is on aurum metallicum 3x for 1 month. Now this man has had prostate cancer, and the cancer was stage 4. It had spread, and somehow he had not taken homeopathy for that. The prostate was operated, and somehow after chemotherapy and radiotherapy, he is quite settled down, except the pain on the ribs. He has, coincidentally, the malignancy has spread to the ribs somehow, the ribs and the spine, and that pain is being persisting. And we have given him aurum metallicum with remarkable results. He stays in a city called Bangalore in India, and he's aged around 74 years, and he's so happy with aurum metallicum. 1 month is over, daily aurum metallicum 3x continued, and the pain is completely gone. And the reason for giving him aurum metallicum was this sentence: decay of ribs, nasal, palatine, mastoid bones. Of course, nasal, palatine, mastoid bones for that patient are normal, but decay of ribs, yes, definitely.
And we definitely think about aurum metallicum as one for a depressed individual.
Yeah,
so
that
was,
is there.
Mm-hmm, so that is also showing?
No, that person is not. Rather, he's a lycopodium person, quite positive that he's going to get well in spite of a stage 4 malignancy. And
okay,
that has really helped us.
I see.
Yeah.
So constitutionally, another remedy, but specifically for the decay in the bones, the aurum met is required.
Exactly.
Okay. So we have 3 minutes to our show, and I suppose we're going to finish up with the last number of remedies in next week's show, which will be Wednesday, and it'll be starting at 11:30. Instead of 10:30 a.m. Eastern time, because of the once a month with Dr. Christina Chambreau. And we're starting our regular show at 11:30 Eastern time because of the daylight savings change. I want
exactly
to thank you so much. It's such a pleasure, and we really go deep diving in depth into medicine and homeopathy with Dr. Adel each Wednesday. Please send feedback, send your questions, send your comments. We do entire shows based on just some of the questions that we get, and who knows what we can learn together. Creating waves of awareness by Twittering out there, putting it on your Facebook, sharing it via email, or capture the widget, the HTML code for the radio player, and put it onto your website. Make this your favorite show. Thank you so much, Dr. Adel.
Thank you very, very much. And it was a pleasure speaking on exostosis. And ladies and gentlemen, I would like to remind you that this is an educational show. Whatever you hear, you can discuss it with me, either in person or with your own doctors, and get them clarified, and only then take medications.
Absolutely.
See you next week. Bye.
Thank you. And I want everyone to know I'm going to give you a quote. I'm going to give you a quote for today. It's: Americans are now looking at homeopathy as an addition or as a complete alternative to traditional Western medicine. This comes from a press release from Martin Sheen, who is doing public broadcasting on a new channel now called Breakthroughs. And if you go to Homeopathy World Community on the Facebook page, you will see a link. You will see a link directly to that press release, and you'll be able to watch. I think his show all about homeopathy will be coming up in May, and this is going viral, so help it to go viral. Right now, there's already 184 shares, and it's been seen by 9,572 people. I think this is the largest.
Wow.
Yeah, all in, I just put it up yesterday, and so far, that's how many people are really excited about this, that even in America, where we are fighting a covert battle against allopathy and the drug cartel, I call it, that people really are seeking out homeopathy and finding that it benefits them. So that's what I'm going to leave you with, and I'll send you off with your music.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.